Yes, we are going. S. So. S. T. A. Stay. Stay tuned. T. T. H. R. O. Through. The. T. Stay tuned through the talking. Because. J. Jen. Is. One. Of. My. F. A. Favorite. P. L. A. Play. Playmate.
Likewise, thanks.
Likewise, thanks. She said, likewise, thanks. We are S O so R E L A relaxed when we P L A play. We are so relaxed when we play. Did we A.I. We did we air you and Jen playing? We aired it on Lover, but I don't know that we've aired it on BTV yet. We did air it on Lover, though. I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
W. E. Well. B. E. T. T. Betty Olds. T. S. T. Stay tuned. Might have something for you.
All right. I think I scared her enough last time I spoke in front of the city council. Come back with a vengeance. That's good.
That is where we met.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was great. Those unfortunate circumstances that we had to meet because they're lobbying a council resolution to censor your show. But
yes.
No, I'm really glad we had the opportunity to meet. It was really fantastic.
You were kick butt when you spoke in front of the council.
No, thanks. I appreciate it.
S. So. S-O. So. P. A. S. S. Passionate. You're very passionate.
Yeah. No, thanks. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was great. Wish I would have known. I wish I would have known more about why you were there. I would have taken some time to put in a word for you as well.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
Yeah. What happened with the reason she was at the city council? What happened with that? The reason you were at the city council?
Well, I mean, I was at the city council because they would, Chris also put up a resolution to support the 79 people who had gotten arrested at a sit-in in Wheeler Hall. We did that on last April 9th. It's the day to commemorate the Deir Yassin massacre. And so it was a, you know, it was a rally to...
What? What is that, the massacre? Tell people that.
Yeah, the Deir Yassin massacre was, I'm not, I mean, I wish I knew more of the specific, you know, historic details, but it was basically, it was when the Israeli army came in and I think massacred what it's like, you know, nearly 3,000, or what's it, like more than 300 people in, you know, a village. It was in the 67 war, so... but so that's been, you know, the day to commemorate that. And it was, I mean, it was part of a larger rally and demonstration to oppose the occupation and then to demand the university to divest from Israel. So in terms of the arrest charges, like right now the charges, the criminal charges have been dropped, but the 40 of us who are students are still facing academic disciplinary procedures. So we'll be going to hearing sometime this fall. So, and we'll see the outcome of that. It could range from anything to warnings to suspension. So there was an informal sort of plea, the equivalent of like plea bargaining, but I think that, you know, that most of the folks who are involved really still strongly believe that we want to fight it in a hearing setting, that, you know, we'd like to have a say. We don't believe that, you know, we don't believe that, we strongly believe that what we were doing was exercising, you know, our right to dissent, you know, and participating in the university, and that, I mean, part of what makes the university, you know, an educational institution is that we have those sort of rights, you know, to politically organize and voice our opinions on campus. We don't think of that as a sort of disruption of business as usual at the university. I think that that's an integral part of, and particularly like at Berkeley, that, you know, celebrates, you know, its history and, you know, political movement. So, yeah.
That is T R A D I tradition, traditional. What E D education was. Traditionally, that's what education was, is C-H-A, challenging the status quo.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And I think that, I mean, one of the fundamental, I mean, problems, I think, not simply with this university, but the way that... largely educational institutions are run so in so many ways counter to the ideals of education, that the universities are run by administrators. They're not run by students. I mean, that this wouldn't have been a problem if, you know, we'd actually have a sort of democratic stake, you know, in our university.
Or teachers, even if it was run by teachers.
Exactly. Yeah. So ultimately, like, you know, the university isn't run, you know, by the teachers. It isn't run by the students who learn there. So I think that,
it is for the C-O-R corporations.
Yeah, no, without a doubt, yeah. So it's largely run as if it's, you know, a business, and I mean, so much of the funding they get is got to do with corporate research. It seems to me that, like, these sort of demonstrations, regardless of their specific content, I think should largely be, you know, a protest against the real lack of, control that we have, you know, as students and as teachers and as staff in the way that the university is run. I think that it's really unfortunate that, that this sort of, you know, that in the forums that we do create, you know, to express, you know, ourselves and our positions, that these are, that these are largely shut down. Mm. So.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. We were at the COCI City Council REALL really for the SA same B battle.
Yeah.
BASI basic reason that the public access channel should be able to be run by the community and not by bureaucrats.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, it seems that, I mean, at least in the specific resolution, you know, about our case, I mean, it was about free speech. It was about, you know, our right to dissent in that way. And I certainly think that, for that to get shut down in the same meeting, you know, as this sort of, you know, resolution, you know, to censor, you know.
What Chris Worthington was trying to do was to get the city council to vote to support the students, the dissenters, and the city council voted against that.
Yeah.
S-U-P support your right to protest, to F free speech.
Yeah.
The city council to support your right to free speech, and they voted not to do that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of I K N, I knew we were in trouble when they voted against supporting your right to free speech.
Yeah, that was a pretty bad indicator.
not a good sign.
No, unfortunately not. Yeah.
F-I-T-H-O. I thought we were in O-R-A Orange County. T, not, not in Berkeley.
Right, right. Yeah, that should definitely be, you know, that's, I think that that's the point where we have to throw up, you know, arms in the air and like, what is this, Orange County? I don't know. Yeah, I think it's so unfortunate that, I mean, that, you know, history that, you know, celebrates, you know, the traditions of the, and as the, you know, one of the birthplace of the free speech movement in this country has, I think, really, you know, has lost so much of the significance of what that entails. So it seems it's...
Why?
Why? I'm not... I mean, I think that... I think that in the current political climate, that there's not, there's less of a consideration of the sort of, ideals involved and what it means to have, you know, the right to freely express ourselves and, you know, the right, you know, to dissent and the right to, you know, assemble, to organize, right? And to have, you know, public forums, you know, to express ourselves. I think that there's certainly a sort of level of, like, sanitizing that's going on where, that people are content to sort of erode and level back the civil liberties that people have struggled for in this country, that were hard won. To erode that back for some sort of semblance of a sort of sanitized order.
Mm.
I guess that's the most sort of generic way I can pose that would apply to both the types of political speech, political demonstration that we were there for, and, you know, the types of, you know, political and artistic, you know, speech that they're threatening to censor in terms of your show and the Dr. Susan Block show.
Is that the H-A-N-G hanging? H-A-N? No, is that changing on campus?
Yeah.
S-I since the W-A-B wave of P O L I police S state. Is that changing on campus at all since the wave of police state?
I think that the general consciousness on campus is does not acknowledge that we live in a police state, and that does not acknowledge even a threat to our rights, our sort of civil liberties on campus. That every time we hold a demonstration, that there's such a heavy police presence. There's not even an acknowledgement of that. That in and of itself is a form of repression, right? So that there's such. I think that largely, although certainly not entirely, there's a sort of consciousness about the cops are there because otherwise it would get out of hand. So that there's people have found justifications for the sort of levels of repression and the constant sort of invasive forms of surveillance that go on campus, and the way that our forms of political expression dissent on campus are sort of focalized and organized. I know that one of the things that happened too was that the administration is very is more attuned to the sort of political expediency of things. There was a decal class on female sexuality that was censured, for example, because it made national press. And so the national press comes out and in some sort of scary way and see, and I'm like, look at Berkeley, they're teaching, these classes that are run by students, about female sexuality, and they go to a sex club in San Francisco, and this is the sort of, sensationalistic, appeals, and then in turn the administration, so... It seems to be.
So when they shut that class down, there was not an uproar among the students about that.
Right. Well, I think there certainly was, and they didn't shut down the class. I know that the decal program came under a degree of like scrutiny after that, but I think that there was enough pressure on campus where they wouldn't have been able to shut down these courses. Uh-huh. They wouldn't have been able to stop offering them. So I think that part of it is a degree of posture, but I think that for every, that it's only because, by keeping constant pressure on the administration that we're able to maintain, you know, the sort of liberties that, you know, that that we demand, you know. So
W O N wonder if I could do my performance series. Oh, I really doubt it. I really doubt it. So Frank did that series at UCB in the 80s, twice a month. It would be like every other Tuesday night. But it was, you know, there was nudity, there was eroticism. It was in Dwinnell. It was just in a classroom.
Yeah. I think he told me about that. That's really hot.
On in W H E E Wheeler. Well, it's actually in Dwinell. It was in Dwinell. Yeah. But yeah, and in that situation, when the security guards complained that there was a naked man in this room, that was Frank laying on a table naked with nobody else in the room.
Yeah.
And when the supporting, it was the ACLU student, some ACLU, no, not ACLU, the, what was it, the ASUC studio, ASUC studio, that's what it was. All he had to say was, we're sponsoring it, and anything he does is okay, because it's performance art, and that was it. You know, for 3.5 years.
But excellent.
It seems unlikely that that would be enough at this point if he was doing the series now.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I really don't know. In a lot of ways, that I think that there's certainly like a very strong, contingency on campus that is really excited about performance art and the sort of in all the sort of range of connotations that has, and sort of breaking, you know, with these sort of traditional boundaries of what we normally think about as what's performance and what's not. So I think that, a lot of people would be really into that, but I'm not. Yeah, it would be interesting to see if you could get away with on campus now. Yeah.
We should.
We're trying that too.
We should try.
Yeah, that's great. No, I would really be in if you were to do a series. I thought Karen Finley did. I think she did one performance.
She wasn't involved in the series that we did, but maybe she performed at UC.
Yeah, I think that was just a couple years ago. Or I mean, maybe even. Yeah, I think just a couple of years ago. I think she was on campus, but I think that was just like a one deal show.
Yeah,
not sure.
She. T A tamed down her art quite a bit. There's a picture of Frank and Karen up there.
That's hot, that's great. I'm not sure, it might have been a larger sort of venue. I'm not sure how participatory it was.
She does like kind of a one woman show.
No, that's great.
How was your trip? Is that it?
I just got back, was it August 4th? It was really intense. I mean, in the same way that it was really intense, I got to meet some really amazing folks. So I was in Jerusalem for a few days and traveling through sort of north of Israel along the Golan and near the borders between Lebanon and Syria. And I was in the West Bank for about 4 or 5 days, and I spent almost a week in the Gaza Strip. So... Yeah, it was I think that like before I went over there, I think I had such an academic understanding of what the occupation was going to be like. I mean, I think it's it's one thing to sort of read about these sort of military incursions, to read about the checkpoints, to read about that there are cities that are locked down under curfew and have been, you know, for months. And but what it really sort of signifies in terms of like people's lives is
2, 3, 23, H, hour, 23 hour. A day?
Yeah, actually, in terms of the curfews, it's not even guaranteed that they'll lift curfew at all during the days. I mean, so, and it's completely arbitrary. There's not advance notice, not much advance notice, that something can happen in the middle of night where, like, people are expecting curfew to be lifted the next day and it's not. I think that that's one of the most, psychologically, torturing aspects is that it's not consistent and that it seems to be relatively arbitrary about whether curfew is lifted or not. It doesn't even really seem to correspond to sort of people's basic needs to leave the house to get food. There'll be some stretches of time where, and it really depends on, different cities. So for some stretches of time, curfew will be lifted from, 9 to 5. But for other days, it'll be, 3-4 days when, curfew isn't lifted at all or is only lifted for, just a couple hours, intermittently. While I was there, I'd heard, it's not uncommon for people. I heard, a couple stories and just, some of the families that we were talking to of, a relative, a family member who goes out during curfew to get something really mundane like food or medicine, from a neighbor's, and will get shot. And so for us traveling around under curfew with our American passports was, we were actually mobile. We could go in the streets, but, for Palestinians who are out, in these cities in curfew, they're shot at. And if they're not shot at, they're at least arrested. But, so I think that was, at least in the West Bank, that was one of the most sort of, remarkable things is, how people, are trying to, to witness, the way that people would get on with their lives with this sort of constant military presence, in the streets with constantly, tanks rolling by with this sort of constant, the sort of background noise of, this military occupation is always there. So it was really extraordinary to see that, the way that, that people so graciously, opened up their homes and their families, to invite us in, to feed us, and, to witness the way that, families there, are trying to get on despite the sort of constant level of suffering.
B. A. Basic. Basically, it is like the J. E. W, I, the Jewish, G, H, E, ghetto, in P O L Poland.
Yeah. I mean, I think that in the sense that, I mean, it's a repressive military occupation. I think there's a lot of, historical parallels to what's going on, in one way or another. I think that, it's so hard. I think that what really sort of shocked me going over there is that what really makes it to the news is the more sort of large-scale, more violent, bloody types of incursions, like the massacre in Jenin. I think in general that it's such a level of like low-intensity warfare. It's it's not bloody enough to be, the constant target, constantly in, like, the international eye, constantly, like, over the press, violent and repressive enough to really make, just going on with everyday life largely impossible for the people living under occupation.
Like, I am a G, imagine B E Berkeley, U under 2, 3, 24. Our C U R curfew.
Yeah.
For Y for years.
Yeah, it's I think that there's something, I mean, that there's something I mean really mind blowing to to look down these streets where, like, the shops are closed, where, like, what would normally be, like, kids playing or taxis running through that are just empty. I mean, the economies, like, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, because of curfew in the West Bank and the checkpoints and the sort of lack of, mobility within these regions for Palestinians, I mean, like, unemployment is, like, upwards of, like, 60-70%. And not just in terms of, like, economic, like, one of the, taken for granted things like garbage. The UN, Relief Works Agency takes care, does the garbage work in Dehesha, a refugee camp outside of Bethlehem, where we're staying, but... I mean, when the city's shut down under curfew for days, there's no, I mean, they can't pick up the garbage, so it just rots in the streets. I mean, it's really, I think that, what does it mean to be locked down under curfew? I think that it's not simply, like, that people's mobility is restricted. I think that it, really, like, affects their lives, and these really... through all sorts of just, it's a totally pervasive, form of repression.
It is a M. It's amazing that they can S-T-A stay S-sane.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I think that, like, I mean, the folks we met, just their sort of level of, you know, perseverance and, you know, commitment, I think is really amazing, you know, that the way that, you know, families and, you know, communities have, you know, have pulled together to survive under these conditions, I think is really extraordinary. In the same way, though, I think we're going through generations of kids now who, I mean, their entire lives, has been living under occupation. And I think that, it's hard for me to speculate on how this is going to impact children, like children who, growing up, as, you know, infants, like, can't go to sleep at night because of the bombs going off, you know, and not necessarily even shelling, but, like, as a form of psychological warfare, you know, at least in the West Bank, it's not uncommon that the Israeli army sets off noise bombs. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, like early in the morning or late at night.
Sadistic.
Yeah. I think that, it's certainly, while I was here, I was really sort of reluctant to dismiss, you know, people whose concerns about the security in Israel seemed hard to dismiss that as illegitimate. Of course, you know, that there's, you know, been fighters who attack, civilians, you know, inside the borders of Israel. And it was hard for me to just outright dismiss those. But, I think that, to be there and see, you know, what's going on, it's so blatantly obvious that it's not about security, that it's not about, security for Israel. It's about making people suffer. It's to try to get them to leave. You know, it's about trying to take over this land.
To be to break them.
Yeah. It's certainly not about the aims are very clear from the types of tactics that they employ are not about, have nothing to do with peace or security. Think that they're about, coercing, these Palestinians to leave.
To where?
To where? I mean, exactly, that's the point. It's not as if, that there's welcoming arms, in the surrounding, regions. I think that even if the sort of surrounding nations weren't totally complicit with the Israeli occupation, for whatever reasons, I think a lot of, the neighboring nations, Egypt, Jordan, are so economically dependent on their relationships with the United States. I mean, that it's not as if they're going to oppose, the occupation now. I think that, I don't think that that's necessarily, a concern. There seems to be, at least in, openly, in a lot of, the public discourse in Israel now, people are really talking about transfer, about trying to get Palestinians to leave. And I don't think that there's necessarily a concern where, and there seems to be this sort of mentality that that doesn't acknowledge Palestinian as a nationality. That there seems to be this extraordinarily racist view that Palestinians are Arabs and they can just go to some other Arab place. Wow. And that there's a sort of view that, that there's a sort of united, homogenous Arab bloc, set up, opposing Israel. They're not recognizing this sort of, national, or not even that. And they're not recognizing, the internationally recognized, legitimate claim these people have to the land. So,
it is a M O O M I N D a mind B blowing I R O irony that they are doing what was done to them.
Yeah, I think that, it's really, I really, it's hard for me to understand, since so many of the people in Israel, have struggled for so long and fighting against, these sort of violent forms of oppression, yet, are willing, to tolerate, if not openly advocate, this sort of brutal and escalating military occupation. It's something that I think, certainly doesn't make sense to me.
Have there been any STU students, studies on that Frank was saying how ironic it is that they're doing the same thing that was done to them. Has there been any studies on that?
Yeah, I think that not that I know of. I think that I think that it's largely people. I guess that on a sort of first level, I think that people are really sort of hesitant to sort of address that because I think that any sort of, in first part because the Holocaust, is of such, a magnitude that, is historically,
but
unreal. But I think...
But this is E, A, equal.
Yeah. I think formally, I think that there's a level of magnitude that's really different, and I think it's important to acknowledge that. I think that... structurally or formally, a lot of the same sort of mechanisms, of repression are at work. So I think that any sort of, and I think that this is in general why in so much of public discourse, like Israel is taken to be, above reproach because, to criticize. What the state of Israel is doing is automatically, you get these allegations of anti-Semitism. Or, the worst is, that what we were accused of is, that you students, this sort of rally and demonstration, the students and community members who were out there supporting against the occupation, to protest the occupation, maybe you're not anti-Semitic, but you feel this air of anti-Semitism that's around us. So many, just to go out and criticize the occupation.
You are D U P E. Dupes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, and I think that, yeah. I'm not sure. But I'm not sure why. Although, like, I'm not familiar with any sort of study on that sort of. I really think that there's an era where people really don't want to experience that as ironic. I think that largely, like, what's talked about in public discourses, it still accepts that what Israel is doing is defensive and not offensive. So, if you look at the sort of newspaper stories coming out of the United States, that the way that they're framed don't even refer to what the Israeli military is doing as occupation, as to the policies as occupation. The sort of context, that there is that the territories that in the West Bank and Gaza are broken up by these settlements and broken up by checkpoints, and that there's a sort of constant, that people's mobility, not even under, they don't have the right to move around freely. I don't think that there's still at least from the way that the U.S. media talks about that, to the extent that they talk about it at all, it's always posed as a sort of defensive, as opposed to offensive strategy. But, I'm sure that there's, and I'm hesitant to, speculate on why the occupation, is tolerated, within Israel, in terms of the United States as well. It's
they.
Amazing that.
B. U. By. P. O. U. Our. A.
Yeah.
R. What?
They buy our arms.
They buy our arms. Right.
Yeah. No, without a doubt. Yeah. So I certainly think that, at least in part, although I don't think that accounts for, I don't think that, I don't want to reduce it to the sort of arms race, but I think that certainly is a significant part, is that not only does the United States, give these enormous, aid packages to Israel. Right now it's, close to $3 billion a year, $2 billion in military aid, and then an additional, what's it, $800,000 in economic aid, which basically is just what defers the economic losses, because of the occupation. By contract, I think Israel spends, another 80% of its military, of what it spends on military hardware on, U.S. arms. In addition to that, I think that, that these U.S. arm manufacturers in general, profit from the military buildup, in the Middle East. Not only, are these arms manufacturers making money off selling weapons to Israel, they're selling these same weapons to, Egypt and Jordan. It's the sort of neighboring, countries are buying weapons from the same sources as well.
O, U, our, K, I, our kid, koala, is, H, A, half, Jewish. He was, O, F, offered, A. All. P. A. All expenses paid. Trip to Israel.
Right.
Two. Get him M to get him to M O move there.
Yeah, there's a bunch of programs internationally, Birthright Israel, that pay for people to come and visit. Usually one of the catches that you have to be, in order to go on these trips, you have to be between 18 and 26. They only want people who are eligible to serve in the military, and at those sorts of ages. And I think that so much of the sort of push to get people to go there, is inseparable from the way that the continuous displacement of Palestinians from their homes. In negotiations, Israel said that it wasn't going to increase settlements, despite that this is illegal by UN law. They continue to build settlements in the occupied territories, and I think that there's such an extraordinarily amount of resources that go into maintaining a presence there to maintain these settlements. So I think that that's.
It is not even N A T U natural G R O growth.
No. Yeah.
It is A. It is getting A R A Arabs out.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I think that so much of the push to get one of the most sort of ridiculous instances of this. Of this sort of drive to, increase immigration. I would argue in order to displace Palestinians, is that the state of Israel seemed so desperate to get people to immigrate there. They have large programs to bring over Russian Jews, right? And one of the things that their sort of background, they're just seem to be just accepting anybody, because it seems that inadvertently they got a bunch of these Russians to immigrate who are not only they're not Jewish, but they're anti-Semitic, so that they bring these people over to live in and they set them up in these great sort of new houses. And if you could see the sort of I can't even imagine the contrast between the way that these sort of immigrants get set up and then the Palestinian refugees or the Palestinian Arabs who live in Israel, blocks away, the sort of conditions. It's like being able to move from the so-called first world to so-called third world, and walking across the street. Literally, they get these people to move in the house, and it turns out that they're totally, anti-Semitic, and they go and deface synagogues, and it's horrible. Frantic and desperate level of just to get people to come to Israel to settle there, I think points out the really insidious logic behind this drive to try to get people to move there.
P-E-R. P-E-R-U, Peru. I.
Peruvian Indians. They went over and converted a bunch of them to, to the Jewish faith, and then moved them to Gaza Strip.
Really? Yeah. No, I didn't hear about that. Wow. It's horrible. I know, and I think that one of the other sort of bizarre, you know, immigration things that's going on there now is that, so that, and in part because of the occupation, I mean, because of the occupation, people, you know, the Palestinians who live in the West Bank, you know, or in Gaza Strip, a lot of them had commuted inside Israel to work as, like, you know, to work as laborers. And since that's been shut down, you know, I was talking to someone like, okay, so these olive fields, you know, belong, you know, to Israeli settlers, but they used to be harvested by, you know, Palestinian workers. Now that the, like, how do they do this now? And basically it turns out that a lot of what's going on is that, you know, and I think that it's subsidized by the government as well, is that they bring in what are effectively indentured servants from, like, Thailand, you know, in Southeast Asia, who come in on, like, sort of three-year work contracts to come in and do agricultural work, who are, you know, who are set up in terms of, like, sort of housing and meals, but have these sort of, like, 2 or 3 year tenures to stay in the country and then to go back. As opposed to, you know.
Wow.
Yeah.
A. L. L. A. M. Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that just the amount of resources that that go into the occupation and you know, Israel's apartheid policies, it's really sort of you know, remarkable the that they're able to get away with it.
But they, in, are, e, a, in reality, they, it, is, m, u, it is j, u, just, l, it is just, a, M, A, G, N, A, F, magnified, C, A, T, I, O, N, C A T I O N, magnification of what is H happening, H here.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I think that, I mean, especially recently with this sort of whole homeland security, I think that one of, I mean, one of the things that I find most frightening is that now we're having these military or security advisors come from Israel to tell us how to do it right here. And I think that, you know, and there's certainly already, I think that, you know, the more noticeable, I think that to see that we also live in, you know, that the space here is militarized, I think, has been largely, sort of separate. That, I mean, in a really sort of, to see that, like, we also live in an apartheid state, I think is not something that's self-evident, you know, for folks who don't have to travel through, you know, areas that are so...
In, one in three, two, one in 32 people are in jail.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not even sure if that counts people who are, you know, somehow within the system, either on, you know, probation or, you know,
it does.
Yeah. Mm.
It does count. P. A. Parole.
Parole, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But. That. But it don't count CRI Crips who are institutionalized.
Yeah.
E, etc.
Right. And I'm not sure if that counts people who are being detained because of immigration status or...
I don't think it does.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that there's all sorts of different ways in which, you know, yeah, that folks are, that it's becoming more acceptable as a sort of, public reaction to, put more people in cages. I mean, in whatever sense that that may mean. I think it's, I mean, if anything, sort of really, I mean, really frightened of the sort of prospects of, you know, what does it mean that, what does it mean, all these sort of new sort of security agencies and all this talk, I mean, about what's going on in this, you know, with the United States government and, you know, sort of totally paranoid, desire to, secure and these sort of concerns that really thinks, I'm really afraid that it's going to lead to some really 1984-esque landscape here.
Yes. One. There. This. B L O this block.
Yeah, we're dealing with it here. We live on a block that when we moved in was a mixed race block and not real wealthy people. And now when families that have been here for generations are moving out, moving in are people who can afford $500,000 for a house. And so it's white people.
Right.
There goes the neighborhood.
Yeah,
oh,
no doubt.
Man.
Yeah.
And so we have, you know, a couple that moved in. She was pregnant, and they didn't want to have their child born in Oakland. And this, so that tells you right away we're in trouble. And so next door to them on one side is a black family that's been there for generations, and it's like several generations that live in the house, so it's like a non-nuclear kind of family situation. On the other side is an Asian guy who grew up in the house. His parents are gone now, and he lives there with his girlfriend. So right away, they call the police a whole bunch of times on the black family because it's intimidating to have to walk outside of her house with all these black men standing out there talking loud to each other.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, my God, that's disgusting. Yeah, I mean, and that's precisely, like, so much of the level of police repression, I mean, is precisely because, I mean, the cops have so much of a license to... I think so much of the policing that goes on is precisely this sort of sanitizing policing, that people don't conform to these sort of, you know, stand, like these, the sort of, I mean, it's talked about as these sort of community standards, or like, you know, filth on the street, you know, people hanging out on their porches talking too loud and, you know, cursing. And I mean, like, things that are absolutely ridiculous, like, you know, hanging out on the curb, you know, drinking a beer. Like,
and that's actually what the police said. Gross. They said they've spent $500,000 on their house. They should expect a certain standard of living. Mm. And it shouldn't include, they didn't say this, but what they mean, it shouldn't include black men standing out on the sidewalk talking to each other.
No, I mean, so much of this, I mean, not simply the repression of, like, I mean, that's just disgusting. I mean, personally, in so many ways. I mean, it totally shuts down. It totally shuts down on the sort of sense of, like, of public space.
Right.
It's like there's a sort of, and I think that it's such a just a twisted economic view that people have, is this is our own personal private property. We've paid, you know, we've paid for this, and we want our little aesthetic bubble. With, you know,
they've put a picket fence up in front.
Like, you rock the picket fence, and you don't want to see your neighbors. And I think that, just to sort of close,
they asked the G U, the guy, across the street, if he would let them put a spy camera up on the corner of his house so they could spy on the family that they don't like.
Well, we have a... Wow, they're just working it for Big Brother. That's fantastic.
And the police,
wow, it's like the
police seem to be happy to have somebody in here kicking up some dust. You
know? Yeah, that's at least to me that all these sort of these. I mean, and this goes like hand in hand with the types of ordinances that you know. The anti-sleeping, all the sort of, you know, ordinances to discriminate, you know, against, you know, homeless people, or, you know, people who are, you know, whatever, like asking for change on the street. I think that there's just so much of that is not got to do with, it's this just insane, like, and totally irrational, a sense of, like, some sort of a desire for a sort of sanitized aesthetic that is totally unprepared and unwilling to look in to the sort of, you know, the types of, you know, social and economic injustice, you know, in this country, right? It's a complete blind eye to really taking seriously the problems, you know, with poverty and underemployment, you know, and lack of affordable housing, to put so much like resources and energy. I mean, the cops get so much money just to run around and, you know, harass people who are like sleeping in parks and, you know, drinking out of you know, brown paper bags. It's really disgusting.
We moved into this house. When we moved into this house, one of the women that lived on the block, one of the first things that happened to us, a white woman, came up to us and said, "This is a really bad street, and you should come to the city meeting, the neighborhood meetings, because we're trying to deal with how bad this is." And we said, "I don't think so." And we decided, you know, to just live here and see what we thought of it.
Right.
But they had, what do they call the substations that summer when we moved in here? That park, it's like this big trailer where the police are on your street. See?
24-hour
presence. Yeah. Really? C-O. That's cops. Cops. H. A. They were hassling. It was like it was a bunch of mixed race teenagers that lived on the street, and so they were like having cars. They'd speed down the street. They had big water guns that they were shooting, This is.
Oh,
like,
I know.
Yeah,
this is some serious, you know. Yeah.
Okay. What we did. What is it? So this is like us kind of, you know, feeling our way through the neighborhood. So we go, this must be these menaces that we see down the street. So Frank said, push me down the street. Mm-hmm. So they're on either side of the street, these, you know, big guys with their huge water guns to see what they would do. Well, they very coolly, acting like we have nothing to do with it, put the guns down as we walk by. Right. And then, you know, so we get past them a few houses and Frank says, okay, turn around and push me back. So we turn around and come right back. And again, they put the guns down. You know, they're cool. They don't act like they're doing it because we're walking by there. Yeah. But there was like zero danger. Nothing. Nada. You know, and this is what the neighborhood was intimidated by.
Oh.
So that was like 7 years ago. And now it seems like, you know, with new people moving in, they're kind of trying to get the whole thing going again.
Yeah. And, I mean, it seems like so that there's such a, well, that I think that's totally done along the lines of race and class.
Yes.
It's so blatantly obvious.
Yes.
And I think that the laws themselves are set up where, like, you can get picked up. If they want to hassle you, you can get picked up for doing anything.
Right.
You know, there's anti-loitering. Mm-hmm. I mean, so if you're hanging out, you're just standing there, I mean, that's illegal.
Right.
They can nab you on that.
Yeah.
You know, if you're walking around, you know, you can be picked up for...
A. If you are B. L. Black.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a young, you know, black and brown, you know, person walking around.
We would sit here in our living room and just watch the cops pull these guys over in their cars over and over and over again, and they weren't doing anything.
Yeah, well,
and they would just get them out of the car. They'd make them stand out in the car and, like, try to humiliate them, you know, in their neighborhood.
Yeah.
They'd have them there for, like, a half hour, 40 minutes, and then that would be it. But, you know, it was just...
Yeah.
It was terrible to watch.
No, it's really, disgusting. Sort of just, and I think that, I mean, what's disgusting too is the sort of, you know, apologists for racial profiling, especially that came out after September 11th and the whole, like, you know, I think that there's all sorts of just the level that people were, were willing to tolerate, like, profiling, you know. Arab Americans, Arabs, and people who look vaguely like they could be. I mean, I think that was really disgusting. But I think it's rooted, you know, in this sort of that I think that there's an unconscious, you know, tolerance for this form. I mean, the types of racial profiling that police, you know, engage in, you know, across the country in terms of targeting. Predominantly, you know, poor, predominantly black and brown communities.
The FI first MIMO month after we moved in, the first month after, on September 11th, there were all the A. D. S. All the ads. A. About. Don't pee. I. Pick. Don't pick. On. Oh, Arab.
Right.
Don't pick on Arab people.
Yeah.
So. But.
You pulled the ads.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You're just saying you stopped seeing them, so you figured they pulled them.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. Well, that's always been the sort of public or conscious front that's behind the racist assumptions that underlie public officials, what the government was coming out and saying at the time, in so many ways that automatically that this was sort of the ways in which in cities, towns, it's like in these newspapers at the time, that these politicians would come out the most ignorant and racist ways equate Islam with like some sort of inherently evil set of practices talk about Arab countries as some sort of like homogenous and unified bloc to talk about. I mean, to just lump entire cultures and groups of people and ways of thinking about the world. And I think that the very way which that these folks were like, if we like a public discourse and like, oh, we need to take Islam seriously. I mean, it was just totally ridiculous that somehow I think that. I don't want to say. I think in so many ways that in skirting, around, the terms involved, there was so much, just horribly racist assumptions that, underlied the sort of, policy decisions that were going on. Even effectively in terms of like policy decisions, like, okay, so there's, like in Afghanistan, like there's a regime that is most likely harboring, these sort of terrorist organizations. And then so that somehow that there's a justification for the United States to come in and bomb with the knowledge that there's going to be, that you're going to be killing innocent civilians. I think that, the entire efforts or the war on terror is largely predicated on the same sort of, the idea that some people are human and others are not. And this sort of distinction, the status somehow, people are recognized as U.S. citizens, have, this right to be treated as humans. When they're killed, then this is something, outrageous. And, if we retaliate in ways that kills people in other countries, then, that this is a sort of, acceptable cost. I think it's really disgusting. Or that, for instance, just the level, the increasing numbers of detentions, like people who are being held, in this country, either by the FBI or by, the INS, I think it points to this sort of same.
Oh. You. Out. Oh, you are. Our. Oh, you are. Oh, you are. K. I. Our kid. Koala. W. O. R. Works. With. A. R. Arab groups. Yeah, he was. At first they were involved in walking people that looked like they would be hassled if you looked
brown or Arab or something. He was involved in that. And then they started to get more involved in just giving the community the information that they need and doing what the Arab community, like hooking them up with attorneys and things like that. B. E. Because. I. N. D. I. Individual. A. Arab. A. T. T. A. Attacks.
Yeah.
Right. Stopped. Slowed down. Right. But. There. Then. The government. So then they had to deal with the government attacking. And so that's how they got involved with that.
Yeah. No, there's... Yeah, there's still a lot, you know, of work to be done. And, I mean, there's still... I mean, I think that... I mean, this sort of, like... the detentions, I mean, are still continuing. I mean, we don't even really know how many folks are being, you know, picked up. Or, I mean, even why. I mean, we know that they're not being held... you know, with trial, some with, like, who aren't even charged, who've been, you know. Oh, it's really disgusting.
How do you keep your P-A-S passion?
Aww. Yeah, I think that, well, that's really, that's a hard question. I think that I really, I honestly believe that we can, I mean, collectively as, you know, as movements, that we can change our own conditions of existence, that we can really change this. And I think that that for me to feel as if I'm part of that struggle, I think is what keeps me feeling a little more sane and a little more happy about, you know, my own life.
Where would were Were you always like that?
Yeah, more or less. No doubt. With a little help from my friends, without a doubt. No, I think that, yeah. Yeah, as far as I can remember. Although I'm still pretty young. You can give me some time, you know. I certainly don't plan on becoming, like, cynical and jaded anytime soon, but whatever.
In H I high school S C in high school, what were when I G R A graduated my J O U R N journal my journal I S. Journalism. Teacher. Who. Was. A. E. X. X word. M. X. M. A. Marine. An ex-Marine. T told me in 5 years, I would be a part of the system. Give up your ideas.
Yeah. Yeah.
That S E A sealed. That sealed it. Damn it.
Yeah. I think if I've been keeping it going for so long, it's only because people tell you that it's, you know, the, oh, give you a couple years, your change. If anything, it's consolidate. So I must be doing something right if it's pissing off the people whose just lifestyle and politics grade against every sort of, you know, inch of my humanity.
Exactly.
No, without a doubt.
P. E. People. Like. B.
Oh, no.
Betty Olds.
Oh, yeah. I knew that, that was long overdue. It's pretty far into the show. I was wondering though, it's coming up. Yeah, that was. It's cold, but perhaps
cold. Read yeah. Your letter, the thing you wrote for the press release,
yeah.
Press conference. So this is what Frank wrote for the press conference tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Hi, I am Frank Moore, the producer slash host of the Targeted Unlimited Possibilities and the sponsor of the Targeted Susan Block Show. It is interesting that this proposed ordinance is designed to target shows by an uppity crip and a smart, sexy woman. Or is it a smart, sexy crip and an uppity woman? My show is politically, culturally, and artistically radical, offering in-depth conversations about issues that affect us all with a wide range of people, live music, and cutting-edge performances, films, and art. We throw everything in this stew for social change, explore everything, including eroticism, to find alternatives. This is what got me targeted by Senator Jesse Helms in the early 90s, and this is why our shows are being targeted now. A few people, including some on the city council, want to sweep these alternatives from public access because they are threatened by these alternatives. Councilmember Betty Olds, who introduced this ordinance, has publicly proclaimed that if she had her way, she would ban these alternatives from our public access channel. She bemoaned the fact that it is illegal to censor or ban community shows on public access channels. This ordinance is an attempt to get around this legal fact. Olds actually has said she would take away BTV, the channel of the community, if that was the only way she could force the removal of the shows that she doesn't approve of. So the real targets and victims of this ordinance are not our two shows, but the people of Berkeley, their freedom of expression on their channel. This ordinance came about when both the staff of BTV and the board of BCM refused to adopt a censoring scheduling policy, following their mission of promoting free speech and diversity. They knew getting some complaints is always part of running a free speech channel. All of us producers were acting responsibly, requesting that our shows be aired after 10 p.m., the standard safe harbor for adult content. But the city council, fueled by very few complaints, decided to ignore BTV staff and producers and the BCM board. It decided to issue rules controlling what could be shown on BTV when. When politicians do this, it should always set off loud alarm bells. This ordinance is a dangerous product of this misguided adventure. It purports to protect children from, quote, indecent programs. It doesn't do this. Again, Olds has admitted that protecting children is just an excuse to get rid of shows that she and people like her find unsettling, etc. This ordinance does not provide cheap hardware to concerned parents that allows them to block any program they deem unfit for their kids. Instead, it does away with the safe harbor of the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. time slot for adult programming. When we were at the city council meeting, this is like 1:30 in the morning, mm-hmm. and when they're reading, talking about this ordinance, mm-hmm. and they all of a sudden, instead of it being called sexually explicit programming, they're mm-hmm. calling it indecent. And there came this definition, which right. is more or less the Supreme Court definition mm-hmm. of obscenity, but they kind of fixed it a little bit where right. they added minor to it, minors, mm-hmm. if it appeals to the prurient interests and desires of minors.
Oh, really?
And if it was designed to appeal to that, the show has to be designed mm-hmm. to appeal to the prurient interests of minors.
Oh, really?
And then it's mm-hmm. indecent.
Then that's indecent.
So Frank just started squealing because mm-hmm. it was like, at that point, well, obviously, right. we're not going to be, no court is going to find the show indecent with that definition.
Yeah.
And so they're throwing away the adult time slot and they're saying, now, only shows that are indecent mm-hmm. have to play after midnight. Anything else can play whenever. So if, you know, if there aren't any shows that are indecent, that means we could play at 2 in the afternoon. They did not really get that. Yeah, and it seems like they still really don't. Yeah. I think it's because they believe so strongly that it is indecent that it's not even an issue.
Testable. Yeah, that's it's so dis- I mean, that's really just it's really vile too, the constant use of the front about protecting the children. I mean to me is just it's so obviously as you said in the letter, it's so obviously about, their own discomfort with the types mm. of, the types of radical erotics on the show, that it's not about sexually explicit. Mm. What's sexually explicit? It's about indecent. It's that this sort of, the sort of representations of, sexuality and sensuality on the show don't conform to their, little sanitized visions of, what erotics are supposed to be about. Wow.
There you go.
So, yeah. The innocent children line. You know that that's always a front for something, It's like, it's not really about the children, is it? No. Okay.
Except for the shows which fall into a very narrow definition of mm-hmm. what indecent is, as defined in this ordinance, all other shows can be shown any time. Mm-hmm. As council members Spring and Mayo pointed mm-hmm. out as they voted against the ordinance, the two targeted shows are not indecent. In fact, BTV doesn't have any shows that are indecent as defined in this ordinance. In reality, this ordinance is not about protecting children at all. It is about chilling free speech. It is about forcing people to do, quote, acceptable shows. Under this ordinance, a producer is expected to label her show as indecent or not. If she doesn't label it as indecent and somebody complains, there is a hearing. This hearing, its process, its rules, etc., are not remotely spelled out in the ordinance. If the show is found, quote, indecent in the hearing, the show is exiled to after midnight. But if the show is found not to be indecent, well, the complainer can do it again next week until the producer is grounded down into watering down her program. This is the real goal of this ordinance, not protecting kids. Well, Susie and I are not chillers. We do not chill. We boil. If this ordinance passes, we will fight lustfully, and we will win. We have to, because, as Chris Worthington keeps pointing out, this would give this and other city councils the power to control what we do and say on our public access channels, and freedom of speech dies. By the way, are we going to let them limit our possibilities?
Ooh. Yeah, that's very poignant. That's well written. I appreciate it.
What? When? Can? We? Pee? Play? Again?
When can we play again? Well, it looks like it's already 10.
So. You mean get the appointment book out?
All right.
Or he means get the appointment book
out. He means get the appointment book out. Excellent. Yeah, we'll see. It's all right. Yeah. Definitely. Mm. Well, I've got to run now. I've got, like I said.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah, let's do it. Again.
Two.
I know.
We. H. A. We had. S. O. So. M. So much. F. So much fun. L. A. Last. Time. Oh, when you were over with the costumes and
that
playing,
was great.
So it was fun. You know how to play.
No, that was really awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. So they, in fact, when... This airs on BTV. Mm-hmm. It'll be followed by the videotape.
Party time.
So if you're watching this on BTV, don't flip your channel now. The good stuff's going to happen.
All right.
Okay, and this is Lover. Mm-hmm. And let's see. Next week is the Visitations. Visitations, a band here from... some other state, which I can't remember. Sorry, Davey. Will be a special live Shaman's Den on Saturday night, and then at 9 o'clock, two live bands, and then talking to Frank, and then we'll replay it on Sunday night during the regular Shaman's Den time slot. Susie Block coming up later and playing with Passions here on Lover. She. If you're in the Bay Area, come to the press conference tomorrow, Monday at noon in front of Old City Hall. Susie Block flew up here from Los Angeles, and I'm sure she's going to be hot. And Frank will be there. So, okay, your player's going to stop. Hit play again.
I'm just like, what did I do?